This week on Making Contact.
I have no clue when I cast my ballot. Who's taking it from my hand? A team of 100 programmers? Who are these people?
If you don't get to elect your president, then what the hell do you get in America?
A healthy democracy depends not only on the leaders who voters choose to elect, but also the systems used to cast votes. When election systems fail, so does democracy. On this Election Watch 04 edition, we'll take a look at the disenfranchisement of African Americans in Florida, the debate over electronic voting machines, and electoral college reform in the state of Colorado. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In the 2000 presidential election, 91,000 people in Florida were prevented from voting because their names incorrectly ended up on a list of ex-felons. This election year, there have been dozens of lawsuits filed to prevent similar events from happening again. But this still leaves more than 500,000 ex-felons in Florida who are not permitted to vote, more than 30% of whom are African American. As Andrew Stelzer reports, the black community is still fighting for their civil rights almost 140 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Voting representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation.
A lot of the older people in the community were going door to door and saying, at the courthouse, you can register to vote this Saturday.
Betty Reed is the political action chair for the Hillsborough County, Florida NAACP. She first voted soon after the 1965 Civil Rights Amendment was passed.
We had two small children at the time, my husband and I, and we bundled up the kids and we stood in line for about three and a half hours. I would never forget that, to have the right to vote.
But still today, more than 5 million citizens, a disproportionate number of them black, are deprived of their basic right to vote.
When you come out of prison and you're in society and you are paying your debt to, you have paid your debt to society, then at that point in time, I think it's just unfair that you're not allowed to vote.
Florida is one of seven states that doesn't automatically restore people's civil rights after completing their sentence. It's called disenfranchisement. Instead, ex-felons must go through a clemency process, which in theory can be as simple as a one-page form, but in reality is an endless maze of bureaucratic dead ends. Just ask Booker Bernard Washington, who was sentenced for 4 years in 1992 for driving under the influence and carrying a weapon.
When I got out, I also signed papers that were supposed to restore my voting rights because I had nothing under the Department of Corrections to do. I wasn't on any probation or anything. I was just free. So I hadn't heard anything from anyone, so I thought it was done. I got a letter from Pam Iorio, who was the election supervisor at the time, stating that my rights hadn't been restored. I mailed a copy of each one of the papers that they told me to send to these different branches of government. Still didn't hear anything. So a year later, I checked and no one knew anything about it. Nobody could tell me anything about it.
The NAACP is one of dozens of organizations that tries to help people through the clemency process. Reed helps people complete their paperwork and send it to Tallahassee, the state capital.
It's almost like you're beating your head against a block wall. There are just boxes and boxes and boxes of files in Tallahassee. It's 600,000 people right now that's in this state that need to have their rights restored, and three people are working on that. So how in the world can this ever be cleaned up? Last year, July 24th, we worked on a list. We completed applications for about 250 ex-felons. And Jackie has been calling that list to find out how many people have gotten their rights restored. And Jackie, I'll let you tell them.
One. That's it. I've called I don't know how many names, and out of that, one has actually received their rights back. Everybody you talk to, they all say the same thing. No one's contacted them. They haven't heard anything.
Jackie Biro volunteers her time to help ex-felons get through the clemency process.
And if you have no voice, you can't tell somebody where you hurt. You can't tell them how bad the economy is for you. You can't tell them how bad the healthcare situation is for you. If you can't vote, you have no voice.
No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation.
The NAACP is also working to have Florida's state laws changed. It's a civil rights issue that goes back further than the organization itself. Christopher Eugen is a sociology professor at the University of Minnesota. He has done several studies on the history and modern effects of felon disenfranchisement laws. Eugen found these laws were part of what was called the Black Codes, referring to legislation that appeared immediately after the Civil War when slaves were freed.
If you look at the historical record, that in many states, the prohibition on felons voting was linked very closely to efforts to avert the menace of Negro domination. The Alabama Constitutional Convention was introduced with that phrasing, you know, the menace of Negro domination.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution was passed in 1865, and by most accounts, it ended slavery. But it does allow for slavery or involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime.
Oftentimes, the list of offenses for which one could be disenfranchised were specifically targeted to crimes that were thought to be associated with the former slaves, things like vagrancy and theft, where other crimes that were quite a bit more serious, such as murder, were not disenfranchising offenses because they were thought to be associated with whites rather than with African Americans.
Do I take it as a racial issue? I certainly do.
Reed says disenfranchisement weighs heavily on the Black community, especially the youth.
When I tell my story to them about how exciting it was to have the opportunity to vote, 50 to 70% of the ones I've talked to have already lost their rights. You know, they already have a felony, so they already know that they feel that they don't have a chance.
The two states that allow people to vote, even when they are still in prison, are Maine and Vermont, two states where the population is more than 96% white. But in the South, issues related to race often divide rather than unite citizens. Al Freimeyer volunteers with the Florida Council of Churches. He is helping circulate a ballot initiative which would end the disenfranchisement laws. He doesn't think modern-day disenfranchisement is linked to racism.
If you went into South St. Petersburg, where the population is predominantly Black, it's going to be an African-American issue. But if you come to Pinellas Park, particularly the neighborhood around Good Samaritan Church, it's all white. It's a justice issue.
Freimeyer, who is planning clemency rights workshops in his neighborhood, is appealing to people's faith for support of the initiative.
It just seemed to be a really unchristian thing to do, and so I got involved in it. It's mean-spirited. It's unforgiving. I can't imagine that the governor would say on his way to church, you can't have your civil rights forever.
There's little incentive for Florida's Republican governor, Jeb Bush, to change the law because Blacks tend to vote Democratic. But Booker Bernard Washington says he's determined to not give up.
It is something that too many people have died and sacrificed their lives, have been in prison, beaten, killed for the right to vote. And I think that if I didn't vote, it would be a disgrace and a mockery of those people who have died for my right to vote, whatever choices I make.
For the National Radio Project, from Tampa, Florida, this is Andrew Stelzer.
With the possibility of election fraud hanging heavy in the air, billions of federal dollars have been allocated to purchase voting machines under the Help America Vote Act. Millions of these dollars have gone towards electronic voting machines developed by private companies. Critics are worried that increased privatization of public elections will only add to the potential for flawed results. Correspondent Jeff Brady takes a look at recent citizen and state actions being taken against these electronic voting machines.
How will Americans know if their vote will be counted this election year? That's a question many concerned citizens and lawmakers are asking, with nearly 80% of votes tallied electronically.
I have no clue when I cast my ballot. Who's taking it from my hand?
Activist and web author Teresa Hommel questions the fundamental structures of using electronic voting machines that don't leave a paper trail and can't be audited or recounted.
Are they really going to put it in the ballot box as I cast it? Are they going to put it in at all? Are they going to replace it with some other opinion? How do I know?
Intended as a solution to hanging chads and other voting problems, the Help America Vote Act upgraded state election systems to digital voting machines or optical scans. For the first time, private companies will be counting most of the country's votes. Dr. Bob Fitrakis, senior editor of the Free Press, author and political science professor, says privatizing the election process is a breach to democracy. In July 2004, he spoke at a nationwide rally called The Computer Ate My Vote.
Government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall remain in the people's hands and not in the hands of Diebold and not in the hands of ES&S and not in the hands of shadowy, proprietary, privatized entities for profit. Democracy belongs to the people.
In addition to the lack of a paper trail, critics do not trust the big three voting machine vendors, election systems and software, Sequoia and Diebold. Diebold CEO Wally O'Dell, a major campaign contributor to the Bush administration, sent a fundraising letter to George W. Bush. In it, he said he was, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. Since that letter made the news, voter confidence has been shaken and outrage has been expressed at rallies around the country. Mary Jo Kilroy is the Ohio Franklin County Commissioner.
Say no to machines that are brought to us by a manufacturer whose stated goal has been to deliver our state to one particular candidate, George Bush.
Carla Christensen with MOB, Mothers Opposed to Bush, also spoke to last year's letter at a Tampa rally.
The man who created and sells those machines promised he would deliver the votes for George W. Bush. Maybe it was his coding and his skewing of those machines, but we will never know unless there's a paper trail, and we will never trust unless there's a paper trail. We're going to insist on a paper trail. When politicians resist that, I can only assume that they have a vested interest in the outcome and that those machines are going to ensure their vested interest.
Diebold and ES&S didn't return repeated calls for interviews. VerifiedVoting.org mobilized this nationwide push for voting accuracy. They're a nonprofit group based in California and are dedicated to creating the awareness among voters that without a paper record verified by the voter, there'd be no way of knowing whether votes were recorded accurately and no way to do a meaningful recount if one is necessary. David Dill, founder of VerifiedVoting.org, and computer scientists, says it was tough to convince private vendors and county election officials that a voter verifiable paper audit trail is needed.
This has turned out to be a much tougher fight than I imagined. It turns out that there are a lot of vested interests of various kinds in the issue. There are people who are vested financially. There are other people who've already taken a position and don't want to back down from it. I don't know quite why it is so controversial, but there are people who can come up with hundreds of reasons why attaching a printer to a voting machine is one of the worst things you could possibly do and virtually cause the collapse of Western civilization.
Alan Descartes is president of the Open Voting Consortium, a long-term project dedicated to creating a cost-effective voter-verifiable voting system. He says a lot of money has been squandered on voting machines.
Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, but there's still billions that haven't been spent, and I think that people should wait, because a lot of this technology just isn't ready.
Grassroots activism in California and Ohio have been successful in effecting change. California officially decertified Diebold machines in several counties because of software security holes. Ohio has required that all electronic voting machines have a voter-verified paper audit trail by 2006. In July 2004, State Senator Fetter walked out to a protest in Ohio wielding a broom.
Anyone who says they don't want verifiable voting, guess what? You're going to be shown the door and swept out. We need a clean sweep in Ohio. We need a clean sweep of the phony voting systems in America.
4 days later, Ohio Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell halted deployment of Diebold voting machines for the November 2004 election. He cited as reasons repeated security flaws and errors in software operation. Another pitfall of increased involvement of private companies are conflicts of interest. Investigative journalist and author of Black Box Voting, Bev Harris had unearthed information showing that defense contractors such as Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin were involved in pushing through the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA.
They were lobbying HAVA to open up new profit opportunities. If you were able to control the vote, then you could control who gets into office, and then we would be talking about large, large amounts of money for defense contractors.
She says this could mean billions of dollars, potentially, for defense contractors, undermining the voting process in order to secure federal contracts. On a smaller scale, financial incentives such as construction contracts and zoning are at the core of local, state, and county vote rigging. But now critics say that rigging a digital vote system can be accomplished on a much larger scale than the old-fashioned stuffed ballot box.
If you could hire some 18-year-old whiz kid to make you senator, wouldn't you?
Investigative journalist Greg Pallast.
If you don't get to elect your president, then what the hell do you get in America? I mean, if there's one thing America stood for, it was democracy and freedom.
The fundamental processes of democracy and freedom will be under close scrutiny this November, says Bev Harris. Harris is organizing a watchdog program to oversee poll workers in many parts of the country. Volunteers will act as election judges, poll workers, and reporters to witness the details of election activity this November.
In other words, every mistake they make, every area where security breaks down, every area where a machine doesn't function right, we need to get that reported, put in the press, and into lawsuits so that they realize that they need to run the election correctly in a transparent way where we can show our work and see that the votes were counted right.
Many are preparing for a contested election this November. Both sides have teams of specially trained lawyers, spokespeople, and political experts to descend into any state demanding a recount. Meanwhile, some voters are finding ways around the electronic machines. Some are requesting paper absentee ballots to be mailed to them. Others are asking for paper ballots at the polls. They, too, want to make sure their vote will be cast and counted this November. For Making Contact, I'm Jeff Brady.
We'll have more about election systems in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. One of the more peculiar features of the political process in the United States is that voters do not directly elect a president or vice president. That falls instead to a group of just 538 individuals, collectively known as the Electoral College. Critics charge the system is fundamentally undemocratic by thwarting the will of the people. As Making Contact's Justin Beck reports, efforts are underway in one battleground state to give some power back to voters.
Polly Baca has been active in politics for over 40 years. She was the first woman of color in the Colorado State Senate, and she served as vice chair for Bill Clinton's first campaign for president. Though Baca has long been in politics, she didn't know much about the Electoral College.
The way I found out about it was in 1992, I co-chaired the Clinton campaign, and I was invited to the governor's office when Clinton won the state of Colorado, and I saw these nine people come in, and they had the right to cast the vote. You know, I never heard about this, and I've been involved in politics since 1960.
Those nine people were Colorado's electors, individuals who alone have the right to cast their votes for president and vice president. The Constitution assigns each of the 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, a certain number of electors, equal to the number of the state's U.S. senators, always two, plus the number of its U.S. representatives, which is based on the state's population. The total number of electors, currently, is 538. In order to win, a candidate must receive more than half the total available electoral votes. Baucus says the experience of seeing Colorado's electors cast their votes in 1992 inspired her to run to become an elector from her district. Baucus is not quite an elector yet, however. Her party's candidate will have to first win Colorado's popular vote. Until then, she says, she's just an elector in waiting.
I will only get a chance to vote if Carrie wins in Colorado. That is what triggers my opportunity to vote for Carrie.
What's troubling to critics of the Electoral College is that a presidential candidate can win the popular vote, but lose the election. That's happened three times in the country's history, most recently during the last presidential race in 2000. In that election, Al Gore won the popular vote by more than 500,000 votes, but lost the presidency to George Bush, who won the Electoral College by just 5 votes, 271 to 266. This kind of outcome has convinced some that the Electoral College should be abolished. Even as an elector in waiting, Baucus says she prefers the idea of direct elections to the Electoral College.
There is absolutely no reason in the world why we ought to have a president elected that does not have the majority of the popular vote. It doesn't make sense to me. The Electoral College makes absolutely no sense with today's technology and today's political world.
Baca even signed a petition supporting an amendment to Colorado's constitution that would change the way the state awards electoral votes to candidates who win the state's popular election. Currently, in all states except Maine and Nebraska, whichever candidate wins the statewide election gets all of that state's electors. This is known as the winner-take-all system. For example, in Colorado's 2000 election, even though George Bush won just over 50% of the popular vote, he got all of the state's 9 electoral votes. Al Gore, with 42% of the popular vote, got none of the electoral votes. But a proposed ballot initiative in Colorado would do away with winner-take-all in that state and instead would allocate electoral votes proportionally to the popular vote. Rick Ritter is a Democratic political consultant working on the initiative campaign.
Colorado was chosen for a number of reasons. The first is that it has a history of reform. We were the first state to allow women to vote. Secondly, the initiative and referenda process here is quite open and robust.
Ritter says proportional representation is more democratic than winner-take-all because it more accurately reflects the will of the people.
The winner-take-all system does not do that. A proportional vote is instinctively more fair than winner-take-all.
It would take a federal constitutional amendment to reform or abolish the Electoral College on a national level. But since states can choose to allocate electoral votes however they wish, the system could be changed one state at a time. If Colorado voters decide to go with proportional representation this November, Ritter says he plans to expand the effort to other states. He says the initiative has received more than enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, and if approved by Colorado voters, it will apply to this year's election results. That possibility doesn't sit well with Colorado State Republican Chair Ted Halaby.
Well, I just think it's simply a bad idea. It does more than split the vote. It emasculates Colorado's vote. If we go apportion it, as is now being suggested in this new initiative, most usually in most election years, you'd probably have a net of one. In other words, a 5-4 split. And no presidential candidate would pay any attention to this state under those circumstances, if the worst that candidate would have is a net loss of one.
Such would be the case in a two-candidate race, but it could be an opportunity for third parties to pick up a few electoral votes. In Colorado, for example, a third-party candidate with just 11% of the popular vote would get 1 out of the 9 electoral votes, rather than 0 under winner-take-all. Rob Ritchie is the executive director of the Center for Voting and Democracy in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He says the winner-take-all system discourages third parties from participating in national elections.
The Ross Perot candidacy in 1992 showed just how difficult it can be for a candidate with national appeal, but not being a major party candidate, to break through. Perot got 19% of the vote, which was, you know, historically high, the biggest vote for a third-party candidate in generations. And yet, so with 1/5 of Americans voting for him, he still, you know, didn't win any of the 538 electoral votes.
In addition, voters may fear choosing a third-party candidate would help their least favorite choice win. Dan Johnson Weinberger is the director of the Midwest Democracy Center and an advocate of direct elections.
In 2000, of course, in Florida, George Bush only got 48.5% of the vote. Al Gore essentially tied with just a touch less than 48.5%. And the rest, 3%, went to Ralph Nader, roughly. Well, what that meant, if you believe that Ralph Nader and Al Gore agree more than they disagree, and that's the majority of voters, that 51.5%, they split the vote, that majority of voters, and allowed somebody else to win with the most votes. That's a real problem, because what it means is if you have an independent or a third candidate, once you get a third candidate in there, it tends to backfire.
One solution to this problem would be to require the winning candidate to receive more than 50% of the popular vote. And if no candidate meets that threshold, a runoff election would be held. But that could be expensive and time-consuming. Johnson Weinberger's answer is to use a method called instant runoff voting.
Imagine instead if you as the voter had the opportunity, if you wanted to rank the candidates. And you had the opportunity to give a first choice with a one to your favorite candidate, and also indicate who your second choice candidate is by giving that candidate a two.
So let's say no candidate receives more than half the popular votes. Instead of holding a traditional runoff vote, the ballots are recounted.
We'd say, well, we're the top two candidates, in terms of the amount of first choice votes you got, you made it to the instant runoff, but everybody else is eliminated. And if you're eliminated, then on the ballots that cast you as the first choice vote, since you're out, we have to look at the second choice vote on those ballots to see who those voters cast as the runoff vote. And we add those second choice votes on from eliminated candidates onto the first choice votes of the surviving candidates, and we see which of the two surviving candidates earned the majority of votes without needing to have a separate election.
A few cities in the U.S. have already begun to adopt instant runoff voting, including San Francisco, which will use the system for the first time in its local elections this fall. Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy says that while there's public support for changing the way we elect presidents, there currently isn't much political energy for reform nationwide. But he says that could change this November.
What could happen again is we could have the popular vote winner not being the president. And I think if the party's hats were reversed in that, let's say George Bush gets more popular votes but loses the presidency in the electoral vote, then you have kind of an equal opportunity outrage.
For Making Contact, I'm Justin Beck.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to the Freedom Singers and Sweet Honey in the Rock, and to production intern Eric Klein. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a cassette or a CD copy of this program, Election Watch 04, Systems Failure, program number 3204, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Brishen McKee, office manager, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.